Hi, I'm Matt Payne, and welcome to 20th Century Revolutions. Episode 2.5, Strolin' to Sofia, Bulgarian Unification, Part 2. Last time, we left off as the last holdouts from the Krasnorezlog uprising in Macedonia were being snuffed out by the Ottoman army and their legions of Bashibazouks. And as we discussed, the Krasnorezlog uprising was simply the first act in what would become a nearly endless cycle of inter-ethnic revolutionary violence within Macedonia as guerrilla bands and government agents and terrorist organizations representing the interests of Greece, Serbia, Bulgaria, and the Ottoman Empire would all vie to establish their dominance over the region in what would come to be called the Macedonian struggle. And when the Krasnorezlog uprising broke out in November of 1878, it already contained within its proclamations many of the future contradictions that would come to dominate the Macedonian struggle, especially amongst the Slavs, as many of the leaders of the uprising sought annexation into the recently established Principality of Bulgaria, while they also professed a desire to achieve autonomy for Macedonia specifically. And this messy division between Bulgarians and Macedonians will become very important as revolutionary activity amongst the Slavs becomes more and more organized in the coming years, culminating with the establishment of the infamous Macedonian Revolutionary Organization in 1893 in Salonika. This organization, often called the MRO, will become somewhat legendary in the years leading up to the Young Turk Revolution. And many of the leaders of the Young Turks, people like Ismail Enver, Ahmed Niyazi, and Mustafa Kemal, the future Ataturk, will get their first taste of battle fighting against the MRO's guerrilla bands within the Ottoman Third Army of Macedonia. But once these junior officers of the Third Army turn their efforts away from fighting Christian guerrillas and instead take aim at overthrowing Sultan Abdulhamid, the MRO and the Young Turks will at least temporarily put aside their differences in a joint effort to establish constitutional rule in the Ottoman Empire. But that is still a ways away, and in 1879, as the last holdouts in Macedonia were being crushed by the Bashibazouks, neither Ismail Enver nor Mustafa Kemal had even been born yet. So, as we said at the end of the last episode, for now we are going to set Macedonia aside. Because in the aftermath of the failed Krasnorezlog uprising, Bulgarian revolutionaries such as Lubin Keravelov and Stefan Stambolov would themselves turn their attention away from Macedonia as they headed back home to take part in the formation of the newly established Principality of Bulgaria. Because remember, the Krasnorezlog uprising had happened just a few months after the signing of the Treaty of Berlin. And the territorial arrangement that came out of this treaty, in which Macedonia was left under Ottoman control, was in fact the reason that the uprising had broken out. But what that meant was that over in Bulgaria proper, the government was still yet to be fully formed. And so many eager Bulgarian revolutionaries, as well as legions of Russian advisors, descended on the Principality of Bulgaria at the end of 1878 to begin the process of crafting a constitution and establishing a new government. Now, our focus today is going to be on the revolutionary process of unifying the Principality of Bulgaria with its southern neighbor, Eastern Rumelia. But the early days of both the Principality of Bulgaria and Eastern Rumelia are very interesting and important in their own right. But a lot of the details fall outside of our immediate narrative. So if you want those details, go check out Eric Halsey's Bulgarian History Podcast. Eric is a great storyteller, and I am super indebted to his podcast as I learned a ton about Bulgarian liberation from Eric. So if you want to dig deeper into the Bulgarian story, go check out Eric's Bulgarian History Podcast. It rocks. But to summarize, as a reminder, at the Congress of Berlin, the big Bulgaria established in the earlier Treaty of San Stefano had been broken up into three separate units. Macedonia, which was left under direct Ottoman control, and then the Principality of Bulgaria and Eastern Rumelia, both of which enjoyed autonomy under Ottoman suzerainty, and which were geographically divided by the Balkan mountain range. Bulgaria was wedged between the Danube River and the Balkan Mountains, while eastern Rumelia lay to the south of Bulgaria in the region called Northern Thrace. But what was most important was that these two provinces had been separated when it was obvious to everyone, especially to the Bulgarians, that these two provinces should be united. Now, even though both the Principality of Bulgaria and Eastern Rumelia enjoyed some level of autonomy, because Bulgaria was an autonomous principality, meaning that they had a Christian prince, it was understood as the heart of the newly established Bulgarian nation, and the efforts to unify would always center around annexing Eastern Rumelia and Macedonia into the Principality of Bulgaria. Okay, so the first several years in both of these provinces, but especially in the Principality of Bulgaria, would be a bit tumultuous with hastily written constitutions and coups and counter-coups and just lots of drama. But in the big picture, the early years of autonomous Bulgaria would be defined by a couple of different tensions. First, there was the tension between Russian political advisors and army officers who had been sent into the country to help establish the Bulgarian government and military, and then local Bulgarian officials and junior officers who chafed under these Russians, who they found to be paternalistic and dismissive of their suggestions. Basically, the Russians would treat Bulgaria as like a colony, while Bulgarian officials and junior officers thought of the Russians as temporary advisors who would leave after sharing all of their knowledge. Next, there was a tension between the two emergent political parties of the country, who would be loosely grouped into the liberals and the conservatives. Most of the old revolutionaries from the days of the Bulgarian Revolutionary Central Committee would join up with the Liberal Party, which generally pushed for a constitution that would have a strong legislative branch that could restrain the power of the prince. Now, Lubin Keravelov sadly died of tuberculosis in 1879, shortly after the Krasnorazlog uprising. But even though Lubin would not go on to take part in building the early Bulgarian nation, his younger brother Petko would become very influential in Bulgarian politics and would actually serve as prime minister on four different occasions. In the early days of the principality, Petko Keravelov and Stefan Stambolov would become the most dominant figures in the Liberal Party. And like I said, they generally pushed for a limited constitutional monarchy that would ensure the individual liberties of everyday Bulgarians. On the other side of the aisle were the conservatives, whose members mainly consisted of rich Bulgarian notables and landowners, many of whom had actually opposed the April Uprising. But now that liberation was here, they planned to hold on to their power. And the conservatives would also sometimes be called the monarchists, as they generally supported a strong Bulgarian prince with broad executive powers because they did not trust everyday Bulgarians, whom they viewed as like uncouth peasants, unfit to participate in government. But who was this Bulgarian prince that the liberals were trying to restrain and the conservatives were hoping to empower? Well, as had happened over in Greece, the Bulgarians would have to look abroad and pick out a prince from one of the noble houses of Europe, because that's just kind of what you did in those days. So, in April of 1879, the first Bulgarian National Assembly elected Alexander of Battenberg to be their prince. Now, Prince Alexander is an interesting dude, and he was mainly chosen because of his family's credentials, as he had ties to the noble houses of many different great powers. He was a German prince who also happened to be the nephew of Tsar Alexander II, and his brother was married to Queen Victoria's granddaughter. So, instead of trying to find a prince who, I don't know, had the potential to be a good ruler, the Bulgarian National Assembly picked Alexander because he had impeccable connections that they hoped would insulate them from being pushed around by any one of the great powers. But Alexander would prove to be a bit difficult from the very start, and he was immediately frustrated by the limits that had been placed on his power. because due to the efforts of liberals like Petko Karavelov and Stefan Stambolov, the first constitution of Bulgaria, called the Tarnovo Constitution, was fairly progressive for its time, and established a constitutional monarchy with a popularly elected parliament that was meant to put a check on the powers of the prince. But the 22-year-old Prince Alexander did not like these restraints on his power very much at all. And to make a long story short, within just 2 years of his reign, Prince Alexander would dissolve the National Assembly and suspend the Constitution as he attempted to assert absolute control over the country. But Prince Alexander's coup largely backfired, as it was met with widespread resistance from the Liberal Party, who enjoyed widespread popularity amongst the Bulgarians. So a bit of chaos followed this attempted coup, and after some shuffling, two Russian generals basically took control of the country, allegedly to reassert law and order. Now, this might seem kind of weird, but like we said, at this point, Bulgaria's administration, both civil and military, was just teeming with Russian officers. And in fact, during Bulgaria's early years, the officer corps of the army was made up entirely of Russians, as Bulgarians were only allowed to reach the rank of captain, which I'm sure did nothing to help the resentment that ambitious Bulgarians felt towards the paternalistic Russians. So after Prince Alexander's botched coup, these Russian generals were sent to Bulgaria by the Russian Tsar, with one becoming the Minister of War and the other becoming the Prime Minister. And well, these Russian generals would prove to be arrogant and paternalistic, and they just started implementing their own policies willy-nilly, paying zero attention to the concerns of local political parties or to the desires of anyone who was Bulgarian. And Prince Alexander was himself not that easy to work with, and he took the heavy-handed snubbing of these Russian generals personally. So Prince Alexander decided to ask the Tsar to please send some more friendly dudes over, but the Tsar refused. And by the way, Prince Alexander's uncle, Tsar Alexander II, had at this point been assassinated by the agents of the nihilist terrorist group People's Will. So we are now talking about Tsar Alexander II's son, who was the Bulgarian Prince Alexander's cousin, whose name was also Alexander. Yeah, it's pretty confusing. But now the Bulgarian prince is dealing with his cousin, not his uncle, and he didn't get along with his cousin nearly as well as he had with his uncle. So, with the prince's cousin, Tsar Alexander III, refusing to recall these despotic generals, the Prince Alexander made the momentous decision to reinstate the Constitution and the National Assembly, both of which he had himself just dissolved 2 years earlier, but which he now thought might help him gain back some leverage over these bossy Russian generals. Now, the immediate result of this weird self-imposed counter-coup was that it seriously strained Prince Alexander's relationship with the Russian Tsar. And from this point on, Tsar Alexander III will basically do everything he can to depose his troublesome cousin. But even though the prince was a bit of a bumbling buffoon, he had somehow played this whole thing kinda well, even if it was maybe by accident. Because anti-Russian feeling had been growing in recent months due to all of those paternalistic Russian officials treating Bulgaria like their colony. So Prince Alexander made his break with the Russians at just the right time, and his decision to reestablish the constitution and the parliament brought him widespread popularity amongst the liberals and the conservatives, something which he had never before enjoyed. So, the constitution was reinstated in September of 1883, and Prince Alexander and his parliament began to get along a bit better. So, the next couple of years were defined by some much-needed stability within the Principality of Bulgaria. But this stability would open up space for Bulgarian leaders to once again start thinking about San Stefano, Bulgaria, and how they could best go about annexing Macedonia and Eastern Rumelia. So, in February of 1885, a group of Bulgarian revolutionaries got together and did what they do best. They formed a secret society. And this one was called the Bulgarian Secret Central Revolutionary Committee, or the BSCRC. And this committee set out goals that were very similar to the early Unity Committee, which had played a central role in the Krasnorazlog uprising 4 years earlier. But the BSCRC had learned some important lessons from their earlier failures in Macedonia. And this lesson was that Macedonia was a pretty tough nut to crack. So they set Macedonia aside for now and decided to put their focus on uniting the Principality of Bulgaria with its southern neighbor, Eastern Rumelia. So the BSCRC began to lay the groundwork for some sort of action to take place in Eastern Rumelia in support of unification. And the plan was for demonstrations to begin around mid-September 1885. Now, the other thing that these revolutionaries had learned from their experiences in Macedonia was that small Chetty-style lightning attacks had not been working all that well since the April uprising, mostly because Russia was still at this point largely uninterested in intervening on behalf of Balkan Christians. So instead of the old guerrilla lightning attack, the BSCRC instead opted to get the Bulgarian government on their side and to see if they might be able to pull off some sort of coup in Eastern Rumelia. So in August of 1885, the BSCRC approached the Bulgarian prime minister, who was at this point Petko Karavelov, younger brother of our old friend Lubin and ally of Stefan Stambolov in the Liberal Party. Prime Minister Petko Karavelov would offer his hesitant support for the revolutionaries because he definitely wanted unification, but he was very worried about what Russia's reaction to unification would be. Then, just a few weeks after this meeting between the BSCRC and Prime Minister Karavelov, the revolutionaries approached Prince Alexander himself and informed him of their plans. Prince Alexander reacted with similar hesitation because he had actually just returned from a trip to St. Petersburg, where he had been trying to mend his relationship with his cousin, the Tsar. And honestly, at this point, Prince Alexander was sort of always trying to mend things with his cousin. But while in St. Petersburg, Alexander had specifically told Russian officials that there would not be any sort of action in support of unification. So now the prince gets back, and unification is in fact what everyone is talking about. But then, events would begin to move quickly towards unification, whether Karavelov or Alexander wanted them to or not. And in early September, about 2 weeks before unification was supposed to be declared, riots began to break out across Eastern Rumelia, and all of the rioters were chanting and holding signs that said, "Unification." So clearly the BSCRC had been very successful in their recruitment efforts. And we've seen this sort of thing happen time and time again, where careful planning goes on for months and months, and then on the eve of the revolt, a bunch of eager beavers get too excited and jump the gun. And then everyone has to just scramble to keep up with events. So, as pro-unification demonstrations were popping off in towns and villages all across Eastern Rumelia, the leaders of the BSCRC hastily threw together an armed militia and made plans to march on the capital of Eastern Rumelia in Plovdiv. And back up north in Bulgaria proper, Prime Minister Karavelov and Stefan Stambolov were frantically trying to decide how best to react to this incredibly precarious situation. Because basically everyone wanted unification, but it was very hard to predict how the great powers would react to all of this. Remember, at this point, Russia thought of Bulgaria basically as an imperial outpost, so the Bulgarians going ahead with unification without consulting the Russians was super risky, especially because Prince Alexander had just reassured the Tsar and his officials that they would not try to unify right now. But ultimately, Karavelov and Stambolov could feel the turning of the tide, and they decided that things had gone well past the point of no return, and that it would be foolish to resist unification at this point. So, Karavelov and Stambolov made their way across the border into Eastern Rumelia and reached Plovdiv, just as the BSCRC was deposing the government there. Now, this coup wasn't really a coup, because the leaders who were being overthrown by the BSCRC actually supported unification. Like I said, everyone supported unification. So this was a completely bloodless coup, and the leaders of the government were like, oh, hey guys, yeah, unification, that's exactly what we want as well. Go on, feel free to take things over, we'll just get out of your way. And so unification was declared. And when Prime Minister Karavelov addressed the jubilant crowds in Plovdiv, he somewhat ominously declared, "Today Thrace, tomorrow Macedonia." With the most prominent leaders of the Liberal Party, including the Prime Minister, now throwing their weight behind unification, and with throngs of euphoric crowds all throughout Bulgaria and Eastern Rumelia cheering on unification and hailing the prince as their savior, everyone's eyes now turned to Prince Alexander. What would he do? Well, as we have said, the prince's relations with Russia had greatly soured over the past few years, and Alexander had also grown increasingly frustrated with his Russian advisors. So the prince basically decided that he would just have to make it on his own without the Russians, and the prince took a really deep breath and decided to back unification. Now, in the end, the prince really had no choice here, because while he was making up his mind, Stambolov and Karavelov had been sending Alexander letters, essentially telling him that his choices were, you either support unification or we will send you into exile. So Prince Alexander decided to stand by his adopted people. And now that he had thrown his support behind unification, the people of Bulgaria loved him for it. The prince basically became the most popular man in Bulgaria overnight. And this newfound popularity largely came at the expense of the Russians, and specifically the Tsar. Because the Russians are going to absolutely bungle this whole thing. And the funny thing is, when unification was proclaimed, many Russian officials stationed in Bulgaria offered their support for unification without consulting their bosses. And they probably did this because it was so obvious that unification by now had unstoppable momentum. But when Tsar Alexander III heard that his annoying cousin had lied to his face and then gone ahead and proclaimed unification without asking him, the Tsar freaked out, and he immediately pulled all of his Russian advisors and army officers out of Bulgaria, who had been stationed in Bulgaria for years in order to help form the early Bulgarian government and military. And it should also be said that the Bulgarians were having to pay the Russians a not inconsiderable sum to have these officials and advisors help them out. So, in making this dramatic gesture of disapproval, the Tsar terribly misread the situation. In his typically paternalistic style, he assumed that Bulgaria would not be able to function without Russian support, and that the Bulgarians would have to come crawling back to him and beg for his fatherly forgiveness. But here's the thing, unification proved to be much more popular than the Tsar, and when he pulled his officers from Bulgaria and denounced unification, the Tsar went from being a beloved liberator to being a two-faced backstabbing scoundrel. And amongst everyday Bulgarians, Prince Alexander, the Tsar's annoying cousin, was now their beloved hero, and the Russians were seen as traitors who had just wasted their precious time and hard-earned money over the past 6 years. And now the Russians were just going to abandon them in their greatest time of need. Because boy, was this a precarious moment for Prince Alexander and the Bulgarian government. They had gone way out on a limb with this one, and it was very possible that they might be invaded by multiple great powers. To start with, Russia, like we have said, was really mad. And then the Ottomans were also really mad, because it is easy to forget that the Bulgarians were still technically under Ottoman suzerainty. So the Bulgarians really had no official sovereign authority, and they definitely could not just proclaim that two Ottoman provinces had suddenly been joined together. But as we will see, Bulgaria will get away with unification without any of the great powers interfering. And this was because Great Britain saw an opportunity in all of this. The British recognized how badly the Russians had just bungled this, and they were aware that the Bulgarians were now having some serious daddy issues with their great Slavic father. So the British decided to back the Bulgarians in their effort to unify. So yes, before you ask, the positions of the Russians and the British towards Big Bulgaria have now completely flip-flopped since the Congress of Berlin. Remember, the British had been the great power most opposed to the creation of Big Bulgaria at the Congress in 1878. But this was mainly because they saw Bulgaria as a future Russian satellite. Well, now that the Russians were clearly losing their grip over Bulgaria, the British saw unification as a great time to try and win some points with the Bulgarians in order to weaken the Russian position in the Balkans even more. Well, for the Ottomans, this complete 180 in British policy towards Bulgaria was just yet another deep betrayal, because the Ottomans had basically given the British the giant island of Cyprus so that the British would back up the Ottomans at the Congress of Berlin and help them to prevent the creation of Big Bulgaria, because Big Bulgaria would mean massive territorial losses for the Ottomans. And now, just 7 years later, the British are supporting the Bulgarians, who were technically Ottoman vassals, rebelliously defying the will of Sultan Abdul Hamid. But reality was reality, and without British support, the Ottomans could not invade Bulgaria and risk yet another costly war with Russia. So they could not prevent Bulgarian unification. So the Ottomans would have to sit back and watch as their former subjects pried away another chunk of territory from the empire. And so the Ottoman presence in Europe continued to rapidly decline. But as it would turn out, it would not be the great powers that the Bulgarians would need to worry about, but instead their Balkan neighbors. And in a foreshadowing of events to come, Serbia will not accept this expansion of territory on the part of their fellow Slavs in Bulgaria. And on November 28, 1885, Serbia would declare war on Bulgaria and launch the first war in what would become an endless series of wars fought amongst these newly liberated Balkan nations. Now, more than anything else, Serbia's war with Bulgaria was the work of their prince, Milan. And in fact, when the wider public heard the news that the Serbian army was being mobilized, pretty much everyone assumed that they were preparing for an invasion of Macedonia to take back their ancestral lands from the Ottomans. But when the real news came that in fact the war was to be fought against the Bulgarians, everyone was shocked and somewhat dismayed. Because broadly speaking, most everyday Serbs at this time felt a sort of fraternal affection for the Bulgarians as their Slavic brothers and sisters. And a lot of people in Serbia initially celebrated the unification of Bulgaria with Eastern Rumelia, because they saw it as a victory within the larger struggle to drive the Ottomans, their common enemy, out of Europe. But Prince Milan thought that he might be able to score an easy victory against the Bulgarians. So when Bulgaria annexed Eastern Rumelia, Milan howled in protest and demanded territorial compensation, arguing that the only way to maintain the balance of power in the Balkans after this dramatic increase in the size of Bulgaria was for Serbia to be allowed to take a large chunk of Bulgaria's western territories. Bulgaria, of course, refused such a demand, and so Prince Milan declared war, citing Bulgaria's breaking of the Treaty of Berlin as his casus belli. Prince Milan thought that the Serbs would easily defeat the Bulgarians, and during the initial war planning, the Serbian prince famously claimed that he was simply going on a stroll to Sofia, implying that he would just casually occupy the Bulgarian capital. But even though Serbia did have a much bigger army with more up-to-date weapons and more experienced officers who had just fought in the recent war against the Ottomans, Prince Milan greatly underestimated the resolve of the Bulgarians, as well as the lack of morale amongst his own troops. Because for the Bulgarians, this was a moment of patriotic self-defense, as they all came together as a people to defend Bulgaria's right to exist. While for the Serbs, this was an unpopular war fought against their fellow Orthodox Slavs. So when the Bulgarian army got wind that an invasion was coming from the Serbian border, Most of their troops were actually farther south at the Ottoman border, because they had originally thought that this is where the invasion would come from before the turn in British policy. After hearing that the invasion was actually coming from Serbia, the bulk of the Bulgarian army would march day and night with almost no rest and in terrible weather, transporting their war material using defunct trains that they had repurposed with old stovepipes, and then just dragging the rest of their artillery by hand. Even while under these conditions, though, the Bulgarian army would make it to the Serbian border with miraculous speed. And what followed was a very quick war that lasted only a couple of weeks, but which ended with the Bulgarians, filled with patriotic spirit, driving the Serbs all the way back across the border until the dynamic of the war had completely flipped, and suddenly the Bulgarians were threatening a full-scale invasion of Serbia. But at this point, the great powers intervened and forced a truce on the two Balkan nations. In the resulting treaty, no territory would be exchanged, but the great powers did agree to recognize the unification of Bulgaria with Eastern Rumelia. So through their patriotic defense of their homeland against the invading Serbs, the Bulgarians assured that their unification would stick. In the long term, this war would be very influential on the future course of events in the Balkans and in neighboring Ottoman lands, because the young nation-states of the Balkans learned a very important lesson from this experience. It became clear that it was essential for these small, newly independent nations to aggressively build large standing armies in order to defend themselves from enemies who clearly surrounded them on all sides. And furthermore, the fact that the Bulgarian victory had in large part been achieved due to nationalistic fervor, it was now believed that it was essential to get the peasant masses of the Balkans on board with the larger project of forging a strong, unified national identity. In practice, what this is going to lead to is that the young Balkan nation-states of Serbia, Bulgaria, Romania, Greece, and Montenegro will, over the next several decades, embark on large-scale projects to militarize and nationalize their countries. And as these nation-states all began to build mass armies made up of soldiers who held radically antagonistic nationalist ideologies, well, it would be an understatement to say that a dangerous situation was brewing in the Balkans. And ultimately, this will all come to a head in 1912 with the outbreak of the First and Second Balkan Wars. These wars would be catastrophic for the Ottomans. And during these wars, Ottoman leaders would learn much the same lesson that their Balkan neighbors had. That in order to survive, it was essential to forge a militaristic nation-state that could wage war as a single homogeneous unit. The Ottoman leaders, who would most aggressively take up this mantle of militarized Turkish nationalism, would be the Young Turk dictators, the so-called Three Pashas, Cemal, Enver, and Talat. Because the Three Pashas would launch their coup of 1913 within the larger context of the crisis set off by the Balkan Wars. And the Three Pashas will use the crisis atmosphere of war to purge the government of all of their political enemies, leaving the Ottoman Empire under the exclusive control of hyper-militant Turkish nationalists. And next week, we will turn our attention to the people who will, in the end, be the most radically excluded group from this new exclusivist and militarist Ottoman identity, the Armenians. Because now that Bulgaria was unified and autonomous, and now that Serbia, Greece, Romania, and Montenegro were all independent, that left the Armenians as some of the last Ottoman Christians with unrealized national ambitions. So in the years leading up to the Young Turk Revolution of 1908, revolutionary activity in the Ottoman Empire will have two main centers of action. The first, as we know, will be the Macedonian struggle, a conflict that will only continue to become more intense in the years following Bulgarian unification. And the other revolutionary center of action will be Eastern Anatolia, as Armenian revolutionaries struggle to defend their communities against the arbitrary violence of Sultan Abdulhamid's increasingly murderous policies. And through these efforts to organize the self-defense of their people, the Armenian revolutionaries will become some of the fiercest opponents of the Red Sultan. And Armenian revolutionaries will help to push their young Turk comrades to take the decisive action needed to finally overthrow Abdulhamid. So, join me next week as we begin our next mini-series on the Armenian Resistance.